Imagine waking up, looking down at your own arm and realizing you simply cannot move it.
Oh, man.
Right. Like
Yeah.
you send the mental command to your hand to form a fist and absolutely nothing happens. The physical limb itself is perfectly healthy. I mean, the muscles, the bones, the tendons, they are all entirely intact.
Right. The hardware is fine.
Exactly. But the biological cable connecting that limb to your brain has been cut off by a stroke. And usually, you know, when we think about physical recovery, the path to healing is incredibly tangible. You break a bone, you get a cast.
You tear a muscle, you do physical therapy.
Yeah, exactly. It's a physical problem with a physical solution.
Yeah.
But how do you rehab a muscle you can't even tell to twitch?
That is the fundamental neurological puzzle right there. Like I said, the hardware of the arm is fine, but the software, or really the wiring routing that software, has been disrupted.
Right.
And repairing that internal wiring requires a complete paradigm shift in how we approach rehabilitation, because the damage isn't in the limb at all. It's localized entirely within the architecture of the brain.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to explore this really fascinating intersection of neuroscience, imagination, and physical recovery. We're pulling from a highly detailed set of materials from a program called Living Beyond Stroke.
Yeah, developed by Jeremy Olson.
Right. And the stack of sources in front of us today includes his clinical program guides, a really deep bibliography of neurological research, and his specific methodologies for guided imagery. We are looking directly at how vividly imagining a movement can literally structurally change the brain.
It's actually a pretty rare collection of materials because it successfully bridges a massive gap.
How so?
Well, on one side, you have these high-level, highly technical fMRI studies detailing cortical activation.
You know, the dense science.
Exactly. But on the other side, you have the practical day-to-day reality of a patient sitting in their living room just trying to regain their independence.
Yeah. And we want to unpack what the science actually says. And, you know, just as importantly, how it deals with conflicting evidence. Because there is some.
Oh, definitely.
Then we'll explore how these insights about mental rehearsal might apply to you, the listener. Because understanding how the brain wires itself applies to how you learn, how you rest, and how you operate every single day.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the core concept that makes any of this possible, neuroplasticity. The idea that the adult brain is constantly rewriting its own circuitry.
Yeah, and for a very long time, I mean decades, the medical consensus was stubbornly fixed on the idea that the adult brain was just a static machine.
Like, couldn't change.
Right. The belief was that once a brain cell was damaged, say by the lack of oxygen during a stroke, it was gone, and whatever specific job it performed was lost forever.
Wow.
But modern research has entirely overturned that static model. The brain is incredibly plastic, meaning it is physically malleable based on how you use it.
And the sources highlight a biological principle here that is crucial for our deep dive. It's detailed in a 2006 paper by researcher R.J. Nudo. It's often referred to as the use it or lose it principle.
Yes. Nudo's work mapped out exactly what happens after an area of the brain is damaged. The healthy brain tissue directly adjacent to the dead zone doesn't just sit there.
It does something.
Yeah. If forced to, it can actually start to reroute the signals and pick up some of the work that the damaged area used to do.
That's incredible.
It is. Sometimes the brain will even recruit tissue on the completely opposite hemisphere to pitch in and help out.
But the sources are really clear that this rerouting doesn't just happen automatically, right? Like, the brain is ruthlessly efficient.
Very much so.
It only dedicates resources to pathways that get heavy signal traffic.
Mm-hmm.
The pathways that get used grow stronger. They wrap themselves in more biological insulation to speed up the signal.
Yeah, the myelin.
Right.
Yeah.
And the ones that go quiet are just pruned away.
Exactly. The more a movement is practiced, the more physical cortical territory the brain dedicates to it. That's the underlying mechanism of why repetitive physical rehabilitation works. You are literally paving a new neural highway.
Which brings us right back to the central dilemma of a stroke.
Right, the catch-22.
Yeah. If your arm is paralyzed or severely weakened, you can't generate the physical movement needed to pave that new highway. You need to move the arm to heal the brain, but the brain damage is preventing you from moving the arm.
It's brutal.
So, since physical practice is off the table, the research points to a biological backdoor into the motor system, basically hacking the brain using imagination.
To understand this backdoor, we really have to look at a landmark 1999 fMRI study by Lotz and colleagues.
Okay, set the scene for this one.
So, the researchers placed subjects inside a functional MRI scanner. This tracks blood flow to different regions of the brain in real time. They had the subjects lie completely still.
Totally still.
Right. Then they asked them to vividly imagine opening and closing their hand.
And what's fascinating here is that the overlapping brain areas, specifically the motor cortex, the supplementary motor area, and the cerebellum, they light up almost exactly as they do when a person is physically opening and closing their hand.
It's mind-blowing.
It is. The brain's machinery just spins up regardless of whether the movement is executed or merely visualized.
Yeah, because the brain doesn't fully differentiate between a physical action and a highly detailed mental rehearsal. It sends an actual measurable electrical signal down the exact same neural wiring.
Even though the arm isn't moving.
Right. It's a weaker signal because the final trigger that causes the muscle fibers to contract is actively suppressed by the brain. But the electrical activity at the origin point, which is the area stroke usually affects, is very real.
The text makes a massive distinction here, though. True motor imagery isn't just looking at a picture in your mind.
Oh, not at all.
The analogy they use in the source has really clicked for me. It's the difference between knowing a song exists, like thinking, oh yeah, I know the song Hey Jude,
sure,
versus actively hearing that song play loudly in your head, feeling the beat, anticipating the next chord, thinking, you know, I should close my hand, does absolutely nothing. You have to actively feel it.
You have to feel the fingers curling. You have to sense the warmth in the palm, feel the slight tension of the grip from the inside out.
Right.
Without that sensory immersion, you aren't firing the motor cortex. You're just engaging the prefrontal cortex in abstract thought. The goal is to generate that internal electrical signal so you can keep the traffic flowing on those damaged neural highways.
So if the fMRI scans prove that vividly imagining a movement lights up the brain on a computer monitor, we have to ask the obvious next question.
Does it actually work in real life?
Exactly. Does lighting up a computer monitor actually translate to a person regaining the ability to lift a coffee cup? We really need to balance the ledger here and look at the cold, hard clinical results.
Right. And the most reliable summary of the clinical data in the sources is a 2020 Cochrane review by Barclay and colleagues.
And Cochrane reviews are a big deal, right?
Oh, yeah. A Cochrane review is widely considered the gold standard of medical evidence. They don't just run one experiment. They act as an independent body that gathers every single trial on a subject, throws out the poorly designed ones to eliminate bias, and pulls the high-quality data together.
Okay, so a massive data pool.
Exactly. Yeah. In this case, they pooled 25 trials involving 676 stroke survivors.
And the conclusion of that massive data pool is that there is, quote, moderate certainty evidence that mental practice genuinely improves arm activity when it's added to normal rehabilitation.
Yep. It's not a silver bullet, but it moves the needle.
But the outcomes vary depending on what part of the body is being targeted, don't they?
They do. Reaching and grasping with the arm and hand has the strongest, most consistent evidence base. Walking and gait have a moderate evidence base. The improvements are there, but they are smaller.
And what about speech?
Meanwhile, using imagery for speech and language recovery has only emerging, very early evidence, so the medical community treats it with a lot more caution.
Okay, I have to pause and push back on this, though.
Sure.
Because as I'm looking through Jeremy Olson's bibliography, there is a massive red flag in the clinical data.
You're talking about the 2011 Scottish study.
Yes. The 2011 Scottish study by Eitzwert and colleagues, this wasn't a small trial. It was the largest, most rigorous single trial they looked at, involving 121 people.
Yep, highly controlled.
Exactly. And it showed absolutely zero difference between the mental imagery group and the control group on any metric. Nothing. So if the single biggest study failed completely, how do we justify the Cochrane Review's positive conclusion? Are we just, you know, wishing upon a star here?
It's a really critical challenge, and the sources are remarkably transparent about this contradiction. They explicitly call the Scottish study the single most important result on the page.
Which is surprising to admit if you're trying to promote imagery.
Right, but in medical science, the better designed and larger a study is, the smaller the reported effect usually becomes. When you scale a trial to 121 people across multiple locations, standardizing the intervention becomes incredibly difficult.
Ah, right. Because how do you definitively prove that 121 different people are vividly feeling the movement rather than just passively thinking about it?
The song playing in the head versus just knowing the song problem.
Exactly that.
Plus, in high-resource trials, the control group is already receiving an exceptionally high standard of physical care, making it harder for an add-on therapy to show a dramatic, statistically significant leap.
That makes a lot of sense.
The early, smaller studies showed massive, almost miraculous gains. The Scottish study showed zero. The Cochrane Review digests all of this conflicting data and concludes the truth is somewhere in the middle. It is an effective adjunct therapy.
An adjunct therapy, meaning it was an add-on. If you just sit in a chair imagining doing your physical rehab instead of actually doing the hard work, it's not going to fix you.
Definitely not. The evidence does not support using motor imagery as a replacement for physical therapy, but we have to look at the other side of the clinical ledger.
The risk profile.
Exactly. Across all 25 trials in that Cochrane review, there were zero reported harms. None. It requires no heavy equipment, no prescription, and no copays.
The psychological factor here is huge, too. Just imagine lying in a hospital bed at 3 a.m. You can't sleep, you can't move your arm, the physical therapists have all gone home, and you've essentially been told to just wait.
That helplessness is awful.
It really is. But having a concrete, evidence-based practice you can do entirely in your own mind gives a patient back their agency. They can actively participate in their own healing when no one else is around.
Regaining that internal locus of control is a massive variable in neurological recovery.
So if the clinical evidence tells us this is safe and effective as an add-on, the immediate hurdle for a patient is figuring out how to actually do it without a scientist guiding them in a lab.
Right, and that's where Jeremy Olson's guided imagery program steps in.
Now, Olson holds a master's in psychology and is very clear that he is not a medical doctor.
No, he's not. What he has done is act as a synthesizer. He took various isolated, scientifically backed components of imagery research and built them into a highly specific four-part structure.
Has that whole structure been tested?
Nobody has run a multi-million dollar clinical trial on this exact four-part combination as a whole, no. But each individual piece is heavily grounded in the biological literature.
Well, let's walk through those four parts because the architecture here is super deliberate.
Okay, let's do it.
Part one is called Breath and Light. You take 2 to 3 minutes to just settle the nervous system. You focus on slowing the breath and imagine a soft warmth gathering at the top of your head, easing physical tension.
Sounds relaxing.
Right. At first glance, this just sounds like standard relaxation.
Yeah.
But there is a real mechanical reason for this in stroke patients, right?
Oh, absolutely. The biological reality of a stroke often involves something called spasticity. When the brain is damaged, it can lose the ability to send inhibitory signals.
The signals that tell a muscle to relax.
Exactly. Without those signals, the muscle stays in a state of constant painful contraction. Pain, stiffness, and systemic stress actively flood the nervous system with noise, making it incredibly difficult for the brain to rewire itself.
So you have to lower the biological static.
Yes.
Calming the nervous system sends a chemical stand-down order, easing that spasticity and making the brain more receptive to the work ahead.
Right.
Okay, so once you've achieved that baseline calm, you move to part two. The ideal being. You imagine a figure standing in front of you. You watch this figure perform the specific movement perfectly, reaching for a cup, opening the hand smoothly and without effort.
Okay.
After observing them, you imagine the figure stepping into your body, and you shift from watching to feeling. But I have a question here.
Go for it.
Why the extra step? Why watch an imaginary avatar do it first? Why not just jump straight to imagining yourself doing it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how human beings learn, we land on observational learning, and that is driven by the mirror neuron system.
Oh.
The sources cite a really fascinating 2004 paper by Rizzolatti and Krigero. They discovered that when you merely watch an action being performed, overlapping premotor areas in your own brain activate, almost as if you were performing the action yourself.
So watching the ideal being is essentially like pushing the clutch in and revving a car's engine.
Yeah.
You're getting the RPMs up in the motor cortex so that when you finally drop it into gear and try to feel the movement yourself, the neurological system is already running hot.
That is a perfect mechanical analogy. You provide the nervous system with a flawless visual template, firing those mirror neurons.
Right.
Then when the figure steps into you, you combine that primed visual circuitry with the stronger internal motor activation of feeling it.
Which leads right into part three, the anatomical pathway.
Yeah.
This is where the practice gets incredibly granular.
Yeah, it's very specific.
You don't just imagine the hand moving. You follow the physical electrical signal through the body. You find that spot in the motor cortex, the strip running across the top of your head like a headband, and you trace the signal down through the brain's white matter.
Which is so important. White matter is essentially the brain's cabling system. It consists of nerve fibers wrapped in myelin, that fatty biological insulation we talked about, which allows electrical signals to travel at high speeds between different brain areas.
And the practice guides you to follow that signal into the internal capsule, a narrow bundle of these fibers.
Right.
This is crucial because this is frequently the exact bottleneck where stroke damage occurs. The practice explicitly tells you not to pretend the damage isn't there. You send the signal directly into it.
You are intentionally directing traffic into the damaged intersection. By rehearsing the parts of the pathway that work and pushing intention into the parts that don't, you are actively encouraging the adjacent healthy tissue we discussed earlier to start building detours around the blockade.
You trace that signal down the brainstem, where it crosses over to the opposite side of the body, down into the spinal cord in the neck, out through the web of nerves near the armpit, and finally into the small muscles of the hand.
You are literally mentally mapping the anatomy.
But the instruction here emphasizes that the focus is purely on the intention to move, not forcing a physical result.
Right. The neurological trying is the practice. Whether the physical hand actually twitches on the outside matters far less than the fact that you are forcing electrical traffic down that neural highway on the inside.
And finally, we have part four. Integration. Breath and light again. You let the imagery fade and just rest for 2 minutes.
Which is vital.
Yeah, this isn't just a cool down. It's a functional part of the neuroplastic process.
Because the brain does not consolidate new learning during the period of intense effort. It consolidates and locks in the structural changes during the quiet moments immediately after the effort ceases.
So if you just hop up right away.
Exactly. If you immediately jump up and start stressing about your emails, you interrupt that biological save process.
Okay, so we've mapped out how to practice. The final piece of the puzzle is when to practice to get the highest return on investment.
The clinical trials give us a pretty good baseline for dosage. A full session of this four-part method takes about 12 to 15 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
The most successful trials suggest doing this 3 to 5 times a week, accumulating roughly 10 to 20 hours of mental practice over the course of a month.
But locking yourself in a quiet room for 15 minutes isn't the only way to get the reps in. And here's where it gets really interesting, especially for you listening.
Oh, yes.
Because these biological timing windows apply to every single human brain, whether you are rehabilitating from a stroke or just trying to master a complex new skill. The sources identify three natural rhythms in the day where the brain is exceptionally receptive to just 2 or 3 breaths of mental rehearsal.
The first optimal window is in the morning, the very first 60 seconds after you wake up.
Right when you open your eyes.
Even before that. Before you reach for your phone, before you fully open your eyes or start planning your day. At this precise moment, your nervous system is still soft and pliable from sleep. The busy prefrontal cortex hasn't fully booted up. And for a stroke survivor, physical muscle spasticity is usually at its absolute lowest.
So whatever you vividly imagine in those first 60 seconds encounters almost no biological resistance.
Exactly.
Now, the second window happens during the day. It's the 90-minute dip.
Yes. This is grounded in the research into ultradian rhythms by Kleitman and Rossi. We are all familiar with our 24-hour circadian rhythm, but ultradian rhythms govern our waking hours.
Okay.
Every 90 to 120 minutes, the human nervous system naturally dips into a short rest and recovery phase.
We've all felt this at our desks. It's that sudden drop in focus, that irresistible urge to just stare blankly out the window.
Oh, yeah.
Usually our modern response is to fight it, push through the brain fog, or go grab another shot of espresso.
But biologically, that softening of attention is a state shift. The brain is pausing to process. The program suggests that when you notice that natural drift, you don't fight it, and you don't need to do a full 15-minute session either.
You simply hijack the dip.
Exactly. Take less than a minute, just 2 or 3 breaths, and vividly recall the feeling of the hand closing or the heel striking the ground.
You slip a quick burst of neuroplastic repetition into an open biological window. And the third window is in the evening, right before sleep.
This leverages the hypnagogic state. It's that fascinating, fuzzy, transitional window where the line between deliberate, conscious thought and spontaneous, dreamlike imagery begins to blur.
I love that state.
It's powerful. Sleep research heavily indicates that whatever the mind is holding onto in those specific minutes before unconsciousness tends to get prioritized, rehearsed, and consolidated while you sleep.
So by practicing, then, you are effectively giving the brain a specific assignment to work on overnight.
You really are.
It is important to clarify, though, that while these three timing windows are deeply rooted in sleep and biological rhythm research, they haven't been definitively proven in specific large-scale stroke clinical trials yet.
No, they are a highly reasoned extrapolation of the science. The goal is to extract the absolute maximum benefit from the brain's natural cycles without adding exhaustion or an overwhelming time burden to someone who is already so fatigued by recovery.
So let's bring all of these threads together. What have we uncovered in this deep dive? We've learned that the adult brain is a highly plastic, adaptable organ driven by the use it or lose it principle.
Yep.
Motor imagery provides a literal biological backdoor into the motor system, allowing a person to bypass a paralyzed limb and stimulate the brain directly.
And the mechanics of this are backed by hard fMRI data showing overlapping brain activation. Plus, it is supported by moderate certainty clinical evidence from Cochrane reviews showing that mental practice improves outcomes when added to normal physical rehab.
We deconstructed a precise four-part method, settling the nervous system to ease spasticity, using mirror neurons to rev the engine, tracing the exact anatomical cabling of the white matter, and locking the practice in with rest.
Right.
And we explored how to optimize this practice by hijacking our natural biological rhythms upon waking, during our 90-minute daytime dips, and right before sleep.
And perhaps one of the most remarkable things about this entire resource is its accessibility. The creator offers the program, the audio guides, and the scripts entirely for free.
Which is amazing.
It really is. He even offers one-on-one Zoom sessions to anyone worldwide based on the Maori custom of koha, which translates to voluntary giving. You give what feels right, what you can, or nothing at all.
It's a brilliant application of complex neuroscience for the public good. Now, you listening to this deep dive might not be recovering from a stroke, but you are operating a brain that learns, adapts, and structurally rewires itself based entirely on where you direct your attention and your intention.
The fundamental laws of neuroplasticity apply to all of us, all the time.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over today. We've just seen the undeniable scientific proof that vividly imagining a physical movement can structurally rewire the motor pathways in a damaged brain.
Right.
If that kind of structural change is possible just by thinking about moving an arm, what other pathways? Perhaps our baseline emotional reactions to stress, our conversational habits with our loved ones, or our confidence in learning a complex new skill. Are we silently structurally wiring into our own brains during those quiet, hypnagogic moments right before we fall asleep?